Welcome to the Finance Administration and Operations Committee meeting of May 14th. Can you please take the roll?
Chair Wolf.
She's on her way.
Director Darcy.
Here.
Director Gonzalez.
Here.
Committee Chair Peterson.
Here. And here comes Chair Wolf. We can, if we wait 1 second, we can get her in the roll.
Good morning. We're calling roll. Chair Wolf.
I'm here.
I have a coffee cake.
Perfect.
Chair Peterson, we have a quorum.
Thank you. Any public comments? I wasn't made aware of anybody wanting to speak today. No public comments today. Item number four, approval of the minutes of the Finance Administration Operations Committee meeting held on April 16th. Were there any comments, additions, changes? There being none, do I hear a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Additional items? I don't think I have any additional items. Can we go to the Executive Director, who I know has additional items?
I do, yes. I'm thrilled to be able to introduce a couple of the presentations that we're going to be viewing this morning. Good morning, everybody, and welcome on this, I guess, overcast. I wanted to say lovely, but it's not quite lovely spring day. It's better than it has been, right? So, first up, we have our quarterly financial review for the first quarter of the year. Mike Kelch and Kathy Williams, I believe, are going to be giving that presentation. So this is obviously the update of our revenues, our budget in the first quarter, and then our capital spending. As you can imagine, with the winter that we experienced and the weather conditions we experienced, we have been impacted by that, so we'll go through that. But I think we're confident that over the course of the year, we're going to be able to stay within the overall budget when it comes to kind of management and operating expenses, at least at this point. So, Mike, without further ado, take it away.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
As Christy mentioned, this first quarter review really is going to reflect largely the impact of the weather on our revenues and some operating expenses in the first quarter, as well as a modest impact on construction, but not a real significant impact on construction because, first quarter, we typically don't have a large percentage of the work done in the first quarter anyway. With respect to the revenue results, revenue for the first quarter, $226 million. That was about $4.8 million less than budget. You'll see on the following slides that that's almost entirely, it is entirely toll revenue and evasion recovery. In fact, we did have some positive results in miscellaneous income that we'll speak to later as well. Maintenance and operations, $827,000 more than budget. It's a combination of a number of items, but it really is overtime and fuel costs. In fact, those costs exceeded budget by more than that amount, but we had some savings in other areas of the budget. Back on the toll revenues, you can see that was down, transactions were down for passenger cars 3.4%, down from projection. That's not down from last year, that's down from projection. And commercial vehicle transactions, despite the very, this severe weather in January and February, we're only down 0.4%. In fact, March, April, we've seen really good and strong commercial vehicle traffic, and passenger vehicle traffic is actually rebounded as well. I mentioned the capital program, $35 million, 34.9 below the budget projection of 180.5. And with respect to, capital program and the timing of the start of the construction season, that's really not too bad relative to what the plan was.
Mike had a question. On the revenue decrease in the first quarter, is it 100% attributable to the weather? And then, does construction have any impact on it? And is it system-wide within the system? Is there any specific area where it was down greater than, maybe the Jane Addams, it was down greater than 294, or did you monitor it that closely?
We do have, I can't answer specifically whether there were specific locations that did worse. We do know the impact was system-wide. I can't say whether, and we can look at that for you before next meeting, whether it was worse in the tri-state or the Jane Addams. But our feeling is it really is weather-related, not construction impacts, because CDM Smith had factored in that we were having construction on the J-Tanup, so any traffic impacts there related to construction should have already been factored into the forecast.
Okay. Do we have to revise this in the second quarter? Do you expect a rebound to basically make up the difference here?
We see the numbers actually have climbed over budget or over projection in April. So what we'll do is we'll continue to monitor it through the second quarter and early into the third quarter.
Okay.
And as we get closer to the end of, as we get closer to preparing the 2015 budget, then we'll be making recommendations about whether or not to adjust that number for the year.
Okay.
Revenue sources and allocations, we thought we'd get really creative, and instead of having tables, put pie charts in.
This is a big moment.
It really does indicate the revenues on the left, that the revenues, tolls, and evasion recovery, no surprise. About $1.015 billion in total revenue, allocated $295 million for operations for the year, $334 million for debt service transfers, and $386 million that we have available to spend on capital projects from current revenues. So for the first quarter, back to our tables. As you can see, what we discussed earlier, toll revenue and evasion recovery down about 2.5% in the first quarter, but miscellaneous income up $1.3 million. That's a one-time fiber optic payment for a new user on our fiber optic system. So in total, revenue down about $4.8 million for the quarter.
Like the investment income, can you elaborate there on that?
Yeah, we had expected short-term rates are very, very low. I think at the end of last year, they were about 6 basis points on much of what we had invested. We were anticipating, as others were suggesting, that those short-term rates would increase slightly. Instead, they've actually decreased slightly. So it doesn't take much of a move, a few basis points, to change these numbers, because they really are so modest in terms of the investment returns. We have hundreds of millions of dollars invested, and we're essentially earning, you know, $500,000 for the whole year. So 6 basis points is a lot of.
You believe that will be adjusted? It will be back on budget.
Well, we will just. This is something where we're going to talk about a little bit more later today. Kathy's giving the presentation on our investment policy. It's one of the items we wanted to discuss a little bit. Some of the options that we have is to consider whether or not to push for a legislative change to authorize municipal bonds, investment in municipal bonds, and or do we want to consider taking a little bit more risk and investing some of our portfolio out longer. We've been reticent to do that because of our priority of preserving capital and preserving liquidity. And fortunately for our budget, this is a very, very modest portion of our budget. As you can see, but for the entire year, $2 million in comparison to $1 billion of toll revenue, it's not a significant piece of our budget. With respect to the maintenance and operations budget, in the first quarter, you can see payroll and related costs were over budget for the first quarter, which is the first time we've probably had that experience in many quarters. It's entirely due to overtime costs associated with the winter storms. In fact, roadway maintenance alone, the roadway, you know, plow operation and so forth, had about $2 million of overtime in excess of what we had budgeted in the first quarter. So the rest of the tollway was actually under budget on payroll and related costs. But not surprisingly, that operation, which is the primary operation responsible during the winter storms was over. Group health insurance was actually down about $500,000 in the first quarter. That was in part due to some changes the state has made to its retiree health insurance program. We also reimburse the state for retirees from the tollway that are state retirees that participate in that program. So because they made adjustments to their program that reduced their costs, we're sharing in that effort as well. Contractual services was down about $800,000. This is a combination of call center costs and credit card fees being less than budgeted. Credit card fees, of course, are down because we collected less revenue. And then in operations, they anticipated what they call a job order contracting administration contract would begin in the first quarter, but that has not yet been awarded. So we had some at least temporary savings in that area. Parts and fuel was the other area that was significantly up from budget, and that again is entirely parts and fuel related to the winter storm activities. So one other aspect of this that we're going to continue to monitor that we think will be important to look at later in the year, materials and supplies, which includes those winter materials, rock salt, calcium chloride, and so forth. That portion of the budget was only over budget by $148,000, but inventories are very low, and we expect to make purchases greater than what we would typically purchase later in the year, so we may see that cost rise as well.
Are those costs fluctuating a lot depending on when you buy them or what's happening in terms of the market or mining? Do we have any sense of that?
They do fluctuate significantly year to year. We do have a contract that has locked in the price through, I'm not sure, Paul, if you know when that contract runs through, but I think it's through the summer months, and then we award a new contract in the fall. Is that right, John?
Yeah, we order, you know, over 100% of what we our estimated quantities that we gave CMS. So now the state is trying to get our main rock salt supply, Cargill, to renew the contract, because I think the average price is around $50-something a ton. And we know on a new competitive bid that price is going to be much higher.
Right. That was
what I was curious about. Do we have? No clue. I mean, we could just speculate. I mean, we're hearing maybe $75-$80 a ton, but
that's a speculation. And do we have enough leverage to be able to get that moving?
Well, we're trying to exercise that renewal. Obviously, the vendor does not want to renew because by contract, they're only allowed to increase their price per ton by 5%.
Okay.
So they're dealing with the state's legal department right now, and if they have to exercise that option or not.
And I assume I got it in the same position.
Yes, they're in the same position. They want to renew as well. And then both of IDOT and us, we'll renew to the maximum quantity that we're allowed to under the contract, but then we're also going to have to put additional quantities on the new bid because, like Mike stated, our salt domes are empty right now.
Mm-hmm.
For the capital program, we had projected about $180 million in spending in the first quarter. We expended about $145 million, so it was about $35 million under our projection for the first quarter. We estimate that between $3 and $4 million of that was directly related to weather and delays caused by weather, that some portion of it relates to business systems and IT projects that were expected to start in the first quarter that have not yet been awarded. And the rest of the variance, we believe, is due to just an assumption that we were going to get a very aggressive start in the year, but which didn't happen, but that we expect to be able to meet the schedule by year end. On those roadway projects. and then we break it out by schedule changes, project cost savings, you can see here. So in recap, severe winter conditions affected revenue and increased operating costs. Revenue $4.8 million less than budget. Maintenance and operations expenditures were $800,000 more than budget. We do believe this is manageable throughout the course of the year. And then capital program expenses were down from projection as well. So, any questions?
Any questions? Well, thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
So as you can see, something we'll be monitoring, but at this point we're not overly concerned because we're seeing the trends move in the right direction. I know Mike, I think, mentioned those material impacts as far as the budget impact will likely happen a little later in the year as we reload our material stores and stockpiles. So, we've been talking about, in the last couple of meetings, reviewing some guidelines that we have, as well as a policy that we have. So I think we're going to start with the debt management guidelines and also use this as an opportunity to update you on our bond sales. So Bill O'Connell, who I think most of you have met before, is going to give this presentation. He's the one who works most closely on our bond sales. We had a very good, I think, outcome. We haven't closed yet, but we had a very good outcome from our recent sale, which he'll go over, but also we wanted to talk a little bit about updating the policy on the debt management guidelines. Some of these are cleanup updates, and there are a couple of, I think, more substantive discussion points that we'd like to have with you. So, Bill?
Good morning.
Morning.
So, the first slide shows what we'll be talking about. As Christy mentioned, we're going to update you on the bond sale that occurred last Wednesday, May 7th. And we're going to discuss the debt management guidelines and interest rate risk management guidelines that are also contained within the debt management guideline document. We're going to focus primarily on liquidity provider diversification and the variable rate versus fixed rate mix that we're allowed to have, and then also make some minor technical or cleanup edits to the document as well. It was a strong outcome for the bond sale. Late April, each of the three rating agencies confirmed the Tollways ratings, which for Fitch and Standard & Poor's is AA- with stable outlooks, and for Moody's AA3 with a stable outlook. These 2014 Series B bonds represent the second new money bond issuance for the Move Illinois program. In May of last year, we closed a $500 million 2013 Series A bond issuance, and this also $500 million issuance was the second issue to finance a portion of Move Illinois. The deal was led on the underwriting side by two senior managing underwriters who represented a nine-firm underwriting group that sold the bonds, or that purchased the bonds, rather. And we were assisted by two financial advisors throughout the process. This next slide shows the progression of the sale. And it's divided into five blocks. On the left side, we have the final maturities and par amounts of the sale that totaled $500 million. And it shows that for all maturities, the interest rate on the bonds is 5%. The second block shows where we started out. And there's really two components when we're discussing our interest rates and yields with the underwriters and the financial advisors. There's two components that produce the yield that we achieve. And one is the municipal market data index for that day, which is a AAA index. And then the other component is the spread off of that index. So most of our discussions are about the spread. So our starting point for this transaction was essentially 65 basis points over MMD. And that was the day previous to the bond sale. So that's where we started out, the morning of the prior day. And then during that day, the underwriters have discussions with investors and try to build up interest in the transaction.
Bill, a quick question.
Sure.
The MMD, that's the high grade municipal index?
It's a high grade municipal AAA index.
And so then our pricing was, we went in with the premise that we would be 65 basis points higher?
In most maturities, the first couple of maturities, we were at 60 and 63, but from, generally speaking, 65 basis points over that index.
Okay.
And we thought that was a good starting point. In the 2013A transaction, we were, we ranged from 63 to 70 spread over MMD. So this was an improvement off of where we finished in 2013.
Right. I have an elementary question for mere mortals. Let's start by explaining what's the implication for the tollway of the spread. What does that mean for us?
It's the market's view of our credit quality, the incremental risk that they demand over AAA, highest quality municipal index.
It's also our cost, right?
That's what I was saying.
Right, it's our cost. The MMD plus that spread is the final yield that we achieve on the bonds.
So it's the amount that we end up having to pay.
Right.
So the smaller the spread, the less we have to pay.
Yes.
The lower the spread.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And just clarify that, not be too technical, but the yield that you see on here is essentially the effective rate that we pay through the call date. So that's 10 years. I think later Bill will have a slide that shows the yields to maturity, but the investor looks at what yield are they guaranteed through the call date, and that's how it's priced.
Correct. So the morning of this.
I guess one other elementary question. What does the basis point mean? In terms of dollars across
the basis point on $500 million, okay, the pressure's on, that would be...
This is your job.
That would be $500,000?
I think it has a present value, of around, in this deal, I think of around $400,000.
Yeah.
It's so much per year, obviously, yeah. But... in terms of the magnitude of what it to us right now, I think that's. And if I'm wrong, I don't know if I'll admit it later.
No, I'm kidding.
I'm pretty sure that's about the amount.
Okay.
That's correct.
So the difference of 10 or 15 is important.
Yeah.
That's right.
Kind of the point I was trying to get to.
Yeah. So the morning of the sale, we were able to tighten those spreads by about 5 basis points in most maturities and go out with a scale that was, for most maturities, 60 basis points over MMD. And that's shown in the middle block. And during the course of the day, the interest was very strong. We built up, or the underwriters built up, a good book of business, and they were able to further improve the spreads to MMD by an additional 5 to 10 basis points. By the end of the day.
I just think this slide is incomprehensible, I think, to most people. So the point is that the underwriters start negotiating with the people who will buy the bonds.
Right.
And they say, we've got a lot of demand, so we're not going to sell them to you at the level that we had cost to us that we had originally said we were going to sell them to you for. You have to reduce what we're going to owe you.
That's correct. The preliminary pricing wire that we go out with in the morning generated sufficient interest in the bonds that we were able to go back to the market and say that we were going to tighten the yields further as a result of the strong interest and set a lower yield on the bonds for the final purchase.
So if there wouldn't have been interest, we would have had to stick with this price?
Yes.
The original price. But because there were enough investors that saw it as a good deal, we were able to get a better price for us, at least a lower cost of borrowing for the tolling.
That's correct.
It reflects also not only the kind of communication with the market about their interest in the toll bonds, but our negotiation process with the underwriters with respect to what they're going to purchase them at before they resell. And of course, you know, they're motivated to get a good deal done, but one that doesn't put them at too much risk for having to hold them themselves. So.
And that was Citibank and Barclays?
Citi and Barclays were the senior underwriters.
Senior underwriters. They take it and then sell it off to others.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Got it.
And so the place we ended up, the final spreads are shown on the right with the movement from pre-marketing to the final wire shown in the last column. So we were able to improve by 12 to 20 basis points during the process. About 1 to 3 basis points of that improvement was a result of the market's general improvement, and the rest of it was a result of improvement from the spread. So on the slide, we have some summarizing information about the sale. It was $500 million was the final par amount. We expect to close on June 4th. The timing of the sale was advantageous due to limited supply. We were the biggest transaction that week, and that helped generate interest. And we're encouraged by the fact that we continue to attract widespread interest from investors. There were over 50 investors who were allotted bonds on this transaction. The bonds were sold with a 5% interest rate, and the yield, as Mike was saying, on an aggregate basis was 3.8% to the call date and 4.3% to maturity. So the yield for the first 10 years, from our perspective, would be 3.8%. You know, we would hope that at that point when the bond...
So yield is our cost.
Yes.
That's what we're paying.
Yes.
The maturity of the bonds,
right?
The 3.8 is for the first 10 years. And then they're callable. So, you know, we would hope that at that time we may be able to refinance into a lower rate. But if we're not able to do that and the bonds have to stay with these yields through maturity, the ultimate cost to us after those 25 years would be 4.3%.
On the payout, on the coupon, is it paid? We paid out annually or monthly?
Semi-annually.
Semi-annually gets paid. We paid it out.
January 1 and July 1.
Correct. And that's in the budget we had it in?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So I don't think it's maybe up here, but not to complicate this any further, but bonds are sold with a 5% coupon, but the bonds, we get paid more than the face value of the bond, and that reduces the yield 3.8% of the cost to 3.8% of what we are able to borrow, the total amount, through the call date. And because the coupon is 5%, which is that increases, if you don't call them out after 10 years, that's going to increase your cost above that 3.8% for the last 15 years.
So when the bonds were sold, you're offsetting the premium that you got at the sale to offset the 5% coupon to get to the yield of 3.8.
Right.
But with the new standards, you used to be able to amortize that premium over that life of that bond. But with the changes, will we be taking that premium all in 1 year as a gain? And then for the remainder of years, we would be looking at a 5% interest.
On the financial statements, the cost of issuance, I think, is what would be expensed initially. The premium would still be amortized over the
life of bond.
The
That's right. So the last bullet point speaks to Mike's point. There were $546.8 million of proceeds generated from this bond issue. That's net of the issuance costs, which were about $2.2 million. And that generates $516.2 million for Moove, Illinois costs and $30.6 million that is required to be added to the tollways debt reserve account. Any other questions?
Congratulations.
Thank you.
The first slide. Mm-hmm. First slide.
Yes, congratulations on getting through the first part of the presentation on the outcome of the sale.
I'm glad we made that.
That's right.
Right. Well, it's good. These questions are helpful, though, because I think they can inform, as we do this in the future, they can inform. We have a little bit more sophisticated audience probably here at the table when it comes to bonds, but we should always remember that the viewing audience, also needs to understand what's going on. So we'll... You guys have done a nice job of trying to get there, and we'll keep working at it. It's complicated.
So the second part of the presentation.
The takeaway is we ended up saving money compared to what we thought we were going to have to spend to fund this issue.
And that the market is now viewing tollways bonds more favorably relative to other, high grade than they did previously.
And that we were able, through the advice of our financial advisors and others, to time the sale in a way that actually improved the outcome for us. So those are sort of the variables as we're going forward we need to continue to pay attention to and think about, and congratulations on all of those things.
That's correct. So the second part of the presentation is to update the debt management guidelines. The slide focuses on two key areas of the debt management guidelines that we want to focus on. One is the diversification of our liquidity providers, and two is the amount of variable rate debt that we want to limit ourselves to. I want to jump to the following slide because it presents the current picture of where we are in each of these issues. The top half shows our current liquidity provider profile, and you can see there's nine providers that provide 10 agreements that provide liquidity that backs our variable rate bonds. So these are the institutions that are going to buy our bonds if at some point the market does not want them. And they are obligated to hold the bonds for a period of years if they continue to not be able to be remarketed during that time.
So this is like an insurance policy?
Yes, it's a backstop for those bonds. And these are the nine financial institutions that are on hook to purchase those bonds if that failure to remarket occurs. And so we have a good diversification here. You can see in the second column, it shows the percentage of the total that each of these institutions provides, and it ranges from as small as 4% that's provided by Northern Trust Company, which amounts to $55 million. And you'll note near the bottom, JP Morgan provides two of the liquidity agreements, one for $191.5 million and another for $95.8 million. So that total for them is $287 million, which is about 22% of the portfolio. At the bottom, we see the total amount of variable rate debt that we currently have outstanding. It's $1.3 billion, and that represents 27.4% of our total debt outstanding. And the fixed rate bonds are $3.4 billion, which is 72.6% of the total debt outstanding.
So as far as industry standards and your comfort level, that 72-27% variable fixed, are you comfortable with that?
Yes, okay. I am comfortable with that. The rating agencies are comfortable with that as well. It's a conservative amount, and it's especially conservative because all of our variable rate debt is swapped to fixed rate with swap agreements. So it's really synthetic fixed rate debt. The underlying debt is variable rate, but we have the swap agreements that remove some of a large portion of the interest rate risk.
Meaning that it can't truly vary drastically, right? Can you just give a two sentence of what a swap does?
What a swap does is it provides to us the average variable rate of the market in exchange for a fixed rate that we pay to them. And so the goal of the swap is that average variable rate that we receive from them approximately matches the variable rate that we have to pay out. And in recent years, it has. So the end result is the fixed rate that we owe to the swap counterparties.
And last month we talked about, we can go back to the last slide, Mizuho Bank, we're comfortable with them, right?
We are comfortable with Mizuho Bank. They have one rating from Fitch that is A-, which is that's their long-term rating, which is a little bit lower than we'd like. But each of the other two rating agencies have them at A+ in the case of Standard & Poor's and A1 in the case of Moody's. Which is a good rating for a bank. And more importantly, the short-term rating is in the highest category from each of the rating agencies. And that is something that's required by our debt management guidelines and is true for Mizuho.
So to put this in context, how often have we had to rely on the liquidity providers?
There was a period from October 2008 through May of 2009 in which we had substantial amounts of bonds that were held by the liquidity providers. And in our history, in our variable rate bond history started in 1993, that is the only period in which our liquidity providers have held whole-way bonds.
And that was kind of the height of the financial crisis, right?
Yes.
So I think a lot of institutions found themselves in similar positions, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yes.
So this sort of went back to the question of the confidence that people had in all municipal bonds, but particularly in the toll-way bonds. We're out of that period now. We
are out of that period, and it was definitely a systemic situation. It was not at all a tollway specific situation.
It wasn't even really a municipal debt issue. It was a system wide.
Everybody was paralyzed.
Right. So coming back to the previous slide, the diversification of liquidity providers. What we've had in the past is a limitation based on a percentage of the total liquidity provided, and the goal has been to limit that to 25% of the total. The second option would be to have a limitation that's the greater of that percentage, which has been 25% of the total, and $300 million. And the purpose of that change would be to address a situation that may or may not occur in which our variable rate debt declines significantly and 25% of the total of the smaller number is just not that large of a par amount.
So if we only had in our whole billions and billions of dollars of portfolio a couple hundred million in variable rate debt, then breaking that up into $50 million increments would probably not be as feasible or would be more challenging than just having one or two liquidity providers for that couple hundred million, for instance. So that's the situation
exactly right.
That you're trying to avoid.
Right. So our recommendation would be to proceed with the limitation that's the greater of 25% of the total par amount and $300 million as a limit for the amount of liquidity that we would obtain from any one provider.
So What's the rationale for the 300 million?
The rationale for the 300 is that historically, 300 million is an amount that we've tended to have on hand in our non-trustee held cash balances.
So in terms of cash that we have available, in the absolute crisis situation where the bank went away and we had variable rate bonds that couldn't be remarketed, we attempted to pick a number that was of a cap that was close to what we feel that in most years we would have that much cash on hand.
That we could just buy it out if we needed to. That way yours is.
Hopefully that would never have to happen.
Oh, yeah. But what I just was curious when you're calculating it, why you think, and that's because of traditionally or historically, the 300 million is the amount of cash that's been available. We would be able to protect ourselves.
Yes.
Is there a downside to doing it like this?
No, the only downside would be if we reached a part of, you know, an amount of debt that the market couldn't cover with multiple providers. And in that case, that's just not a situation that we foresee occurring.
I mean, I would add that, I mean, it exposes us to a little bit more risk to one provider under certain situations, a risk that we think is mitigated by the fact that we historically had the cash. But the positive side is the efficiency that you would have with respect to if you have a small amount, not having to break it up. So those are the kind of choices.
And the efficiency is a cost question? Or is it?
I think it's both a cost, but maybe even more so a management or administrative effort.
So it's cost of time and effort, not in the traditional financial sense, but just the
and on occasion, there have been times where, it's not often, but been times where you may not be able to find four separate providers to offer.
For such small amount.
Yeah, aggressive rates.
And the second update that we want to focus on is the mix of variable rate versus fixed rate bond. The guideline that we have had in place is a goal of reaching 25% of variable rate bonds as a percentage of the total amount of debt outstanding. When we include the fixed rate series 2014B bonds that we've sold, the percentage of variable rate as a percentage of the total has declined from 39% in 2010 to 27% currently. So we've definitely made a lot of progress towards that 25% goal. And if we continue to issue fixed rate bonds as we expect later this year and in 2015, at some point in 2015, we will be within the 25% goal that we had established.
Why do you want any variable rate?
Variable rate is traditionally a lower cost than fixed rate debt. And the times at which we've issued variable rate debt, and again, we've always issued it in connection with a swap, so there's really a synthetic fixed rate that has been achieved. At those times, that synthetic fixed rate was lower than the traditional fixed rate that was available in the market. And so it's all about cost savings. The only reason we would issue variable rate if we were achieving cost savings.
So if interest rates started to go up and up and up, we're still at very low interest rates, right? Historically low, we're getting very good deals. But if interest rates start to skyrocket, for instance, and we can't get those low rates, this is a tool that we can use to balance in the short term and then fix out later, but it gives us some flexibility.
That's right.
To continue to issue and hit that overall, I think our overall goal for the Blue Illinois program was, you know, 5.5%, right?
That's correct. So it's an option we want to continue to have, you know, as our debt issuance grows throughout the Move Illinois program. You know, a couple of years from now, we'll be at $6.6 billion in total debt outstanding if things go according to plan. And with this type of limitation, that would allow for $1.6 billion of variable rate. So, you know, a modest increase from where we are currently. But still a percentage that we think is reasonable and manageable and an option worth having.
Do you have any sense what other entities like us do in terms of guidelines on variable rate?
They most do have guidelines. I can look into that and see what the average is, both policy-wise and in their actual portfolios. I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah, I think that might be useful. I mean, really what we're talking about is taking a risk versus saving money, right? So.
Yes, yes. It's projected savings versus incurrence of additional risk.
And many have both. Many other toll wings have both have unhedged or variable rate debt.
Without the swap.
Without the swap. And there's a very good case that can be made for having some of our debt as unhedged variable rate. We talked earlier about you know, having hundreds of millions of dollars invested at near zero. So in this interest rate environment, we would be paying a very, very, very low rate of interest to that. And if you had unhedged, several hundred million unhedged. So some would argue you can have a certain portion of your debt that fluctuates with the market as long as you have cash that you're investing, but it fluctuates with the market because they naturally kind of offset each other. But at the time we did these transactions, and when we looked at an overall long-term financial plan and tried to achieve a certainty of cost of borrowing, we decided it was better to hedge it with a swap or fix it with a swap. And the advantage at that time was you lowered the overall cost relative to traditional interest rate.
So I don't want to preempt the chair here, but I'm going to do it anyway. I think it might be useful at some point, if we can do it, is just to lay out what are the costs on this. What's the cost with the of the actual swap that we would use as the safety net on this, and how would that compare to not having the backup, and what's the cost of having the liquidity buyers, just so we can because what we really are doing is asking the board to think about risk versus cost, and it's very hard to understand from this what are the built-in costs in the debt that you don't necessarily always see.
So we can certainly do that. We have gone through some versions of the presentation as we talked about swaps and fixing up
right.
Swaps, as you recall. So we can update that, but I think you're also asking some additional questions. So is it fair to say that maybe there's, I know you've had a chance to review some of our edits. Again, some of them are just kind of catching up on, they're really more kind of edits versus policy decisions.
Right.
So is it fair to say that on update number one, are we okay with option two, which is our recommendation as far as the more substantive edit? On update two, I think we're really recommending to kind of keep it as is, but you want to have this other discussion, which I think is an important one, so we'll start working on that.
And I'm not opposed to two.
Okay.
I mean, I think 25% sounds sensible. I think it would just be useful for us to see how do we compare with other entities and what are the building costs that we're incurring in order to feel that we're mitigating risk. I trust your judgment. I think we've done this for a long time, and the market is telling us that we've got it right, which is important, and so I'm not trying to second guess it. I just think it's useful.
Because we did make a conscious effort to bring it down from about 40%.
Yeah.
Because the rates have come down, we said, let's lock it in, let's fix it now, let's get on the variables. And so it's come down from about 40% down to 27, now it's going to go to 25 shortly.
And I think that part of our rationale for the 25% a couple of years ago when we looked at this was also kind of the rating agency's response at that time during that crisis about limiting your exposure to variable rate. And it, while they don't specifically say you can't have more than X, we're kind of getting the sense that 25% was something that they were comfortable with.
So, but that's good. We'll take a look at kind of other, you know, toll roads or bond issuing entities similar to the tollway and come back and try to do the best job we can in, you know, creating a presentation that gives you that information, but also we can have some discussion around issue. Again, you know, the cost that we incur to be, to have a more conservative approach and manage the risk and the exposure that we have, you know, if something goes wrong.
Can I ask a quick question just so I can get a little more clear? When I take a look at the slide before this, and there's $30.6 million going into debt reserve, is that part of that $300 million pool that you're talking about, or is that a difference?
That's a different pool. Yeah. Under the, we actually have more than $300 million right now that the Treasury holds that we're in part using to fund, in large part using to fund the capital program in addition to the bond proceeds. But that's the $300 million we're referring to here is in addition to that reserve. Yeah.
After you went to the market with $500 million, you had about, what, $46 million in premium? That's what makes up that he's talking about.
That's what helps fund the reserve.
So you're keeping $16 million in the Boom, Illinois, and you're taking 30.6 of it to the debt service.
Yeah, because we're required under the bond, the indenture, to have an amount in reserve with the trustee that equals the maximum amount we pay on the bond, the maximum debt service we pay on the bonds in any one year. That's a requirement of the, and it's cash that eventually, you know, if bonds were ever to go away, which probably not in my lifetime, but that it was cash that would come back to the tollway. So it's being held in reserve. At one point.
So it's another safety precaution.
It is. And in fact,
investors take comfort from that.
Yeah. Right.
And in fact, you know.
And that exists because if the tollway stopped functioning for some reason and we didn't collect our revenue, we would be able to pay for our debt service for at least
for a year
while we fixed whatever problem it was, which is hard to imagine what would happen that would cause that, but we'd be able to make those debt service payments for that year.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And that's in the indenture? That's in there.
Yes. So that brings us to the last slide, which is other updates that are of a minor technical or cleanup nature. We want to incorporate certain Dodd-Frank provisions. The first listed here is municipal advisor registration requirements. This is a requirement that financial advisors register with the SEC. It goes into effect July 1st of this year. Our current financial advisors in our financial advisor pool have already done this. It is their obligation, but since it's a new SEC requirement, we want to monitor it, you know, make sure we include it in our RFPs, and so we're going to add that to the guidelines. And the second item under Dodd-Frank relates to swap agreement protocols and communication requirements and requirements to have a qualified independent representative on swap transactions. This is something that we already addressed with the board late last year, and so we're adding that to the debt management guidelines as well. The most important part of this is that late last year, we authorized that each of the firms in our financial advisor pool could act as a qualified independent representative on our behalf for swap transactions. And the purpose of that is that from the swap counterparty's perspective, if we have a qualified independent representative, then they do not have a fiduciary obligation to us. And so that is something they require in order to proceed with a swap transaction. Other items, other cleanup items are to clarify that issuers' counsel and disclosure counsel are included among roles for which the legal counsel pool pre-qualifies firms. The previous language mentioned bond counsel and underwriters' counsel, but did not mention issuers' counsel and disclosure counsel. And so we're adding those. We've added the post-issuance compliance procedures that are there to ensure that after the issuance of the bonds, we comply with the tax code requirements for using tax-exempt proceeds. And then we've also updated certain job titles and committee names where appropriate, and committed to a review of these guidelines at least biannually. That is it. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay. So, the presentation we've all been waiting for, the third and final.
The most dynamic.
At the March Finance Committee meeting, we discussed updates to the tollway investment policy. So that investment line we saw earlier in the quarterly financials, the quarterly financial review, obviously is directly impacted by, of course, the laws that govern the investments that we can make, but by our investment policy. So we wanted to take this opportunity to review and hopefully update the investment policy. I know you've received some materials in the last couple of months to take a look at. Kathy's going to walk through some of the changes that we would recommend, and also I think some maybe broader policy discussions about legislative changes that we may or may not want to pursue that would give us more flexibility in the investments that we can make. Fair to say. So Kathy, take it away.
Thank you. So, as Christy mentioned, I think by now you've received copies of the red line copy and the final copy of the update to the investment policy. You've probably also received previous updates, and you should receive the applicable statutes that relate to this update with respect to the Illinois Public Funds Investment Act and the permitted investments under the trust indenture. So we've sent that out before. So the purpose of this presentation is really just to go through, again, the purpose of the policy, to discuss the changes that we've made to the policy. I will say that the changes are mostly clarification and minor edits. And then have, a discussion on expanding the allowable investments to include municipal funds. So again, the purpose of the investment policy is really to set forth the framework regarding the investment of tollway funds. It helps to define the parameters under which how funds should be managed. The applicable statutes include the Toll Highway Act, the Public Funds and Investment Act, and also the Trust Indenture. So these are the statutes that govern our investment policy. Our primary objective and from the investment of tollway funds is the preservation principle. We seek to undertake investments that always maintains the preservation and safety of our principal. The secondary objective is liquidity. We always want to make sure